Copyright enigma. One of the interesting things about copyright law is its interaction with technology. One of the things that copyright law is constantly having to do is to renew itself in response to challenges from new technology. And the history of various copyright industries, and the music industry is a very typical one, is sort of marked out by lots and lots of different problems with new technology. If you go back in the music industry, for example, in the United States, the record companies in the United States in the 1940s had a big problem with live performances. And the Musicians Union in the United States said, we are going to ban people from making sound recordings because it's putting live musicians out of work. And there was a big recording ban in the 1940s, which actually explains why Latin American music became very popular in the record industry in America, because all the recording companies were in Havana, where the ban didn't apply. So constantly through the history of copyright law itself and copyright industries, you have this tension between technology and copyright and the provisions, and this constant need to respond to what we call disruptive technologies. But say for the last 20 years, there's another dimension to this issue that I'm particularly interested in, and I wanted to talk to you about tonight before Fogelter turns up and talks about the particular aspects of this for the music industry. One of the statements that you will see frequently when you're listening to or reading about recent developments in copyright law, is you will hear a famous statement by a former publisher and lawyer called Charles Clark. Now, Charles Clark was a very distinguished book publisher and a great lawyer, and towards the end of his career, he represented the trade associations working for the publishing industry. In the early 90s, he and I and many other people were at a meeting at WIPO in Geneva talking about what became the new conventions in 1996. And I remember one day we had a morning session, then as we tended to do, we went for a long lunch with lots of Swiss red wine. And in the afternoon, we came back into the main chamber at WIPO and Charles Clark stood up and made a very famous statement. He said, the answer to the machine is in the machine. Then he sat down and promptly went to sleep, as I think I did as well. But this statement has been used over and over and over again, most recently in the Hargreaves Review report that came out earlier this year. It's a big idea that if you have a problem in copyright law with the machine, then somehow the answer is in the machine. Well, there's lots of different kinds of machine. There's one very famous machine, the Enigma machine, and presumably they found the answer for the Enigma code in the machine. But I'm not sure, and that's the point of my talk this morning, whether for copyright the answer actually is in the machine. And everybody bandies about this expression, the answer to the machine is in the machine. I'm not sure it is, because what I wanted to do very briefly this evening is just go through some of the history of the different kinds of technologies we've tried to use in the last 20 years to protect copyright, or to manage rights in copyright works. One of the first things, and this is lost in the mist of time, but back in 1989, the record industry, and the music industry generally, had a problem. It was doing very well, thank you, with a new format called the CD. The CD was a great improvement in sound quality, durability, as a medium generally. It took over from something called music cassettes and LPs. And it was a great development. But then, of course, Philips, Sony, and everybody else started thinking, can we make a recordable version of the CD? Can we do with digital technology, what we did with analog technology with the music cassette, which created this problem where consumers could buy blank cassettes and copy all the music they wanted off the radio or off a friend's record collection at home, the private copying problem. The problem with digital copying like that was that it created a perfect copy, and a perfect copy of a perfect copy of a perfect copy. So the problem of private copying of music using a digital source like a CD and a digital, there were various recording formats. There was something called digital audio tape. Then Philips came along with something called the digital compact cassette. That lasted about 3 months. And then Sony, of course, had the mini disc format, which was a digital small disc that you could record. There was an agreement struck between the international recording industry and the Japanese and European consumer electronics industries in Athens in 1989, which basically introduced a technology called serial copying management system. Now, the interesting thing about this system, SCMS as it came to be known, was that it worked in this way. The recording industry was very frightened about domestic digital recording equipment. And so it went to the Japanese and the European consumer electronics industry and said, we need to stop this. We need to put copy control in there so that unless we give permission for a copy to be made, it cannot be made. The Japanese and the European consumer electronics said, well, no, that's ridiculous. We can make a first generation copy. But look, we do understand that making subsequent, a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy is a problem for you because a digital copy is the perfect copy every time. So we will, as long as you allow us to make the first generation private copy, we will work with you to introduce technology to prevent copying from that copy. So the recording industry sort of went away and scratched its head and thought, okay, well, if that's the solution, we better invent a problem to match it. So we came up with this idea that serial copying is a real problem. So we got this agreement about serial copying management system. Now, that's the answer for the recording industry. It's very interesting. Why is a DVD encrypted and a CD is not? The reason is very simple, is because we went for SCMS. And why did the recording industry go with SCMS? For two reasons. One, at the time we made that deal, Sony, the Japanese corporation, was buying what was then CBS Records. The second reason was that the head of the RIA, the Recording Industry Association of America, was very concerned that if we didn't get the deal, limiting the control of copying on these machines, he would have to fight the importation and sale of digital audio recorders in the United States, and that was against the background of a very famous case called the Sony Betamax case in the United States, which actually said, if there is some other use for a copying device, then you cannot hold the manufacturer as responsible for copyright infringement. You cannot block them from selling those devices. It's a lot more complicated than that, but that's the general idea. So that is why we now have DVDs that, because the video industry took a more robust line on this, and they actually agreed an encryption standard for DVD video, which did prevent first generation copying. Whereas for audio CDs, they couldn't stop first generation copying, and that's had some ramifications. All these formats are long gone. I mean, you might have to go to a museum to see a VAT tape these days. The next thing that came along, this is the next area of technology I wanted to talk to you about, DRM, Digital Rights Management. Now, this sort of started coming along in the mid-1990s, and the company that I joined in Santa Clara in 1999 was a company called Intertrust, and it had a very interesting idea for protecting copyright works as they were disseminated. The original idea behind digital rights management was that you could take an optical disc, you could load it up with copyright works, particularly literary works. you could encrypt them on that disk, and then people could buy an entire library for virtually no money, and then pay a little bit more money for the, or whatever the price was, buy a key to decrypt different pieces of content within that disk. Okay, that was the original idea behind DRM, and it's a very common idea now. You can download a piece of software for a trial period, and then you buy a key to unlock it for permanent use. The idea of DRM, but then the idea of DRM, digital rights management, grew. And people were beginning to think, well, we can use digital rights management technology to manage copyrights in protected works generally. And the idea was that you could take a work like a sound recording, you could encrypt it, you could package it and deliver it to a consumer. The consumer would have on their computer what we called a secure processing environment, an application that would receive the piece of encrypted content, would receive the key to decrypt the content so that you could access and use it. But the way that the key was made available to the consumer to actually decrypt the content was controlled through a user interface, which basically set the rules by which you could use that key to decrypt the content and use it. In simple terms, what that meant is you could download a song from Universal Music, it would sit on your computer, you couldn't use it until this thing popped up, said, do you agree to pay 10 cents each time you play this song? And if you agreed, and the bit that we couldn't do very well in Intertrust, if you had some way of paying the 10 cents, which we couldn't figure out, nobody could at the time, but anyway, that was the idea, you could agree to that, and every time you played that song, the DRM technology would kick in, and it would allow you to play that song, and your budget of a dollar was gradually decremented each time you played that song until you had no money left, and that was it. And you couldn't play that song unless you used the DRM. And the idea was that you could really replicate some basic copyright licensing models with this simple, to the user, apparently simple technology, which basically said, do you want to play this song? Yes, that's 10p, click here, bang, done. Of course, the technology behind that was incredibly complicated and never properly worked. And as I said, we never solved the micropayment problem with all of that. But very quickly, it didn't work. As a consumer proposition, we tried to release music online with partners. We did a project in France with Daft Punk, an interesting band, you could buy an album, a CD from Daft Punk, and in the back of it was a credit card looking thing which had a code on it, which was your access to a site where you could, I'm going back 10 years in time now, where you could download extra music and videos of the band, stuff that we take for granted now, but 10 years ago was pretty leading edge. There was a huge consumer negative reaction to DRM. One, because it didn't work, and I used to sit in the company in Santa Clara, and I was the guy who was providing sort of first level consumer support, and I would get a constant stream of telephone calls from people who were trying to use this technology complaining that, you know, I'll soften the language, would you please remove this technology from my computer? It didn't work at all. But more importantly, there was a huge consumer backlash saying, the internet is about sharing stuff, information wants to be free, you're preventing access, and of course Lawrence Lessig was one of the leaders of this charge. At the same time, there were challenges, there were people like, there was a guy, I forget which academic institution he was at, but Professor Ed Felton tried to reverse engineer some of this and was caught with some of the anti-circumvention provisions of the US copyright law. It became a very nasty mess, and by about 2003, DRM was beginning to smell really bad as a consumer proposition. There was even one day, I believe, there was street demonstrations in Seattle outside, you know, to tell Microsoft, don't use DRM. And as you can see from here, the music industry had to respond, and it's responsive to its market, and it had to rethink the whole thing. One of the interesting things, though, about DRM is the kind of DRM I was involved in developing was a consumer disaster. We were horrible because we did look as if we could lock up all this content. There was a much better application of DRM technology used by Apple in the original iPods. If you remember, if you bought one of the first iPods, you could only play on that iPod music that you downloaded from the Apple iTunes site. And how did they do that? With DRM. But nobody noticed that bit until, I guess it must have been 2006, 2007, when in February 2007, there was this famous open letter from Steve Jobs, which basically said, I'd give up DRM in a heartbeat because I don't think consumers want it. I was forced to do this by the record industry. I did it for them. I don't need to do this. Well, actually, he did it because he wanted to carve out a market dominant position for the iPod and for iTunes, and it was a very, very clever tactic. But by 2007, in places like Norway and France and other places, the government was beginning to say, hang on a minute, why can't you play iTunes songs on any other devices? And why can't you play anybody else's downloads on the iPod? Something wrong here. So, 2007, Steve Jobs says, well, I guess I've got 85% market share for the iPod. We can live with that. There's a few storm clouds emerging in terms of competition problems in Europe. Maybe it's time to give up DRM. Plus the fact, I think, that the record industry by that stage was saying, he's getting too big for his boots. He's telling us what we can do with our recordings and so on and so forth. Time to break free. Which they did also with Amazon. If you remember, in the second half of 2007, the recording industry went live with Amazon, which was then selling the first MP3 DRM-free downloads. So DRM was over. The dream of being able to have this technological implementation of copyright models was really over. DRM is still there. DRM is no longer a major factor on the iPod, but it's used all over the place in terms of controlling access to content. But the idea that you can actually enforce business models in great detail, that idea has really gone away. And the other thing that consumers didn't like about this, of course, is that DRM technology collects a tremendous amount of information about what the consumer is doing. It has to. And a lot of people quite obviously said, this doesn't feel right, that we have to give up all of this information just to use the content. So that became an issue as well. One of the next areas of technology that we started thinking about, fingerprinting and watermarking. Fingerprinting technology is where you take, for example, a music file, you analyze the music file, and you are able to extract some unique features of that music file. And from those unique features, you are able to give a unique code to that particular piece of music. If you like, some people, you know, you're extracting the DNA from that particular sound recording. You can then put it in a database. You can match that up with information about the copyright in that. And I'm sure everybody's using it here. When you rip a CD, when you're ripping it into iTunes or something, that system is reading the contents of the disc. It's sending it off to a company called Gracenote. Gracenote has got huge databases with about 15 million individual music tracks, all with their fingerprint and with the corresponding information about the song title or the recording title. And it all comes back to you. There was another company in California called Audible Magic, does the same thing. One of the things that people thought you could do with fingerprinting was to build boxes that sat in the networks that could identify stuff that should not be passing through the networks. In other words, unauthorized file sharing. The idea that you could block files that were not authorized to pass through the network because they were not authorized by the copyright owner. The idea, and Audible Magic set out to actually do this. They started building boxes that would sit at network nodes, and they could identify music files that were passing through, extracting the fingerprint, finding out what the recording was, checking that with a whitelist, saying, should this be going through this network? No, it's not on the list, block it. And that was the idea. And that was the subject of a report in a famous Belgian case, which was brought by the local music collecting society called Saban. And they were trying to stop one of the local Belgian ISPs from transmitting this traffic in unauthorized files in music. And there was a report produced by Audible Magic for the court, because the court wanted to find out, well, is there something that the ISP could be doing to block this traffic? Is there a technology? And Savo argued, yes, we can use fingerprinting. And they produced a report. Nothing really came of it. And to the best of my knowledge, although Gracenote is still around doing a lot of business, Audible Magic is still around doing a lot of business, but they're not really doing anything to do with copyright control anymore. It really didn't happen on that level. Digimarc is a company which does something else. I said fingerprinting is where you find some unique features in a music file and you can apply a unique code. Watermarking is the opposite. You actually put some code into the music file. And you do it in such a way that it doesn't interfere with the music file in any way, but it can be there. It's like a watermark in a banknote. It's there. You can use it then for doing lots of things. But you have to put it into the piece of content. Still around as a technology, very popular, but it's really not taken off as the broad-based solution for dealing with copyright management online. The next thing, metadata. We talk a lot about metadata systems these days. Everybody's got a metadata system. Everybody's got a metadata project going on somewhere, where you can take what we're doing on an ordinary business basis and reduce it to code in some way. And the idea is that now you can create music files which are not just about the music, but they have lots of headers and tags in which you can describe them, you can connect them, you can even encode what you can do with them. And the dream of some people is that as the internet becomes more and more intelligent and moves to what people call the semantic web, in which all data is intelligent and can be connected to other data through all of these metadata structures, you can actually, according to some people, you can codify the entirety of the contents of the world and human experience, and it all interconnects and it's marvelous stuff, so that you can actually manage copyright simply through the application of metadata and the processing of metadata, so that copyright licenses are sort of self-defining and self-enforcing in a particular environment. Okay, so you find a piece of music on the internet that you want to use, it comes to you in a file which has got a header and it's got tags in there and it tells you what it can be used for. And so if you try and use it for something that's not authorized within the metadata, it won't work. But if it is authorized, it will report back to the big copyright processing plant up there in the cloud. And everything will be authorized and paid for and all the rest of it. We're nowhere near getting that sorted. We're nowhere near. I'm sure Fiddle's going to talk to you later about the efforts that are involved in pulling databases together just to figure out who owns what. Getting this kind of metadata together is, you know, that's 10, 15, 20 years out there, I believe. But it's an area we have to look at because there's a lot of work going on and it's a great idea. But we need to get the basics sorted first. WIPO, I mentioned at the beginning. In 1996, WIPO brought in two major new copyright neighbouring rights treaties. The WIPO Copyright Treaty, or WCT, and the WIPO Performances and Phonographs Treaty, WPPT, dealing with the same kind of issues in respect of performers' rights and sound recordings. And two very, very important innovations in those treaties were the first international standards established in relation to what they would call technical protection measures and rights management information provisions. Basically, it says that if copyright owners choose to use technical protection measures, there should be provisions in copyright law which prevent people circumventing those technical protection measures. Equally, if a copyright owner goes to the trouble of creating a file which has got those kind of tags I've been telling you about connected with them, rights management information, then there should be protection for that rights management information, and there should be penalties for people who try and interfere with that process. So there was a certain amount of international recognition of these developments in the use of technology to help in the protection of copyright works, help in the management of rights in works. But look at the timing. 1996, we agree these treaties in Geneva. 1999, something called Napster comes along and kind of throws the whole thing open again. And I'm sure in the early 90s we'd known about Napster, these treaties might have looked a bit different. But anyway, they are what they are, and they still have very important provisions in them. One of the things I think we're seeing, and this is the last slide in this presentation, is that there are things going on, but they're not related to particular kinds of technology. What we're beginning to see within different industries, within different sectors, within what we call different content verticals in the film industry and the television industry or the photographic images industry, you're beginning to see some of the players use what I call, this isn't an official term, what I call systems-based licensing. If you look at the system Plus is a very interesting model to look at. If you want to get a license to use a photographic image that you have found somewhere that somebody is making available on the web, you can use the Plus system to actually get a license to use it. I won't describe it in detail, it's a very simple system. You can go there and have a look at it. And we're seeing more and more of that. DDEX is something that the music industry has developed, and it's basically for sharing information about how copyright works, how musical works are used. It doesn't actually do any licensing, but it could do. And it's a very interesting standard that the music industry has invested heavily. It's working. It does a very efficient job. Creative Commons. Now, Creative Commons, I'm not talking about in terms of its model, but the way that Creative Commons is implemented, there's a certain amount of automation in that. You can use certain icons for indicating what rights you want to reserve or what rights you're concerned about. That's a very simple way of using technology in the process of granting a license to use a copyright work. CC Plus is a further development of that. Onyx is a system used in the publishing industry. The publishers who are making content, literary works available in libraries, now have a way of saying within a library context, here is a coded system which enables your machines to know what they can use and what they can't use and what they can share and so on and so forth. So we're beginning to see people develop systems to actually create licenses. But we've gone in a way from that idea of DRM, where you could actually package up content and only make it available through these very, very specific applications that consumers had, to systems which are much simpler and not trying to achieve so much. I think one of the things, and the reason I asked this question, is that true, that the answer to the machine is in the machine? I'm not sure it is, because I think copyright is much more complex in practice and in implementation than can be captured in an algorithm or in a machine implementation. There are too many moving parts in copyright. It seems very simple, but it is actually regulating a very complex set of transactions that really can't be reduced. I mean, the wealth of copyright jurisprudence that you'll go through, as you study copyright, just shows you how many different issues have to be addressed in what appears to be very straightforward in situations. Copyright can do that. Copyright can do that, in traditional ways, but reducing that to machine-readable functions. Certain things are happening. Certain things are moving forward, and I'm working with projects now. The Hargreaves report that came out earlier this year talked about the development of a digital copyright exchange. That tends to point to the idea of a stock exchange and a big bang and a new way of managing markets and so on and so forth. I personally remain skeptical about whether that's going to happen in the short term, because I think, as I say, I think copyright and the way copyright owners want to use their rights are really too complex in practice to be reduced to machine. So that was a brief sort of history of the way that technology has tried to be used over the last 20 years to implement copyright, to protect the rights that copyright owners have, and to manage them. And there's been lots of attempts, and I think we're still looking. So I'm not yet convinced that the answer to the machine is actually the machine. You may have other thoughts. Thanks, anyone.